I'm Al Filreis, and this is Poem Talk at the Writer's House, where I have the pleasure of convening three friends to collaborate on a close, but not too close, reading of a poem. We'll talk, maybe even disagree a bit, and perhaps open up the work to a few new possibilities, and we hope gain for a project that interests us some new listeners. And I say listeners because Poem Talk poems are available in recordings made by the writers and artists themselves as part of our PennSound archive, writing.upenn.edu/PennSound. Today, I am overjoyed here in Philly at the Writer's House in our Wexler studio by Michelle Taransky, a poet whose books include Sorry Was in the Woods, Barn Burned Then, and the 2020 chapbook Abramowitz Grossberg. A longtime brilliant, brilliant teacher here at Penn of seminars in critical writing and also creative writing, once a full-time staff member of this very creative place, this community, the Kelly Writer's House, and always a dear friend to me and us, and by Brooke O'Hara, director, artist, performer, teacher, lots of other things, who has been creating and performing the 9-part project I Am Bleeding All Over the Place, Studies in Directing, or 9 Encounters Between You and Me, and who also co-created with Sharon Hayes Time Passes, an 8-hour performance using an audiobook sound of Virginia Woolf's To the Lighthouse, and is, among many other things, the co-director of the Performance Intensive, and teaches here at Penn, a member of the faculty of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing, Creative Writing Program, and by special guest, because he came from relatively far away, Chris Funkhauser, the one and only Chris Funkhauser, a unicorn, if I might say, whose book, Prehistoric Digital Poetry, An Archaeology of Forms, 1959 to 1995, has been kept. Check out that span of dates, okay? Prehistoric Digital Poetry that ends in 1995. You got to love it. Has been fundamental to those of us trying to understand what's happened in this field since 1995, whose other works include New Directions in Digital Poetry, Press Again, great title, Subsoil, Lutes, another great title, and scads of papers, articles, presentations worldwide, whose magnificent recordings of poets can be found all over PennSound, where he has been a collaborator since the beginning of that project, since I think the beginning or almost the beginning.
2010.
That's okay, yeah, halfway through or a third of the way through, including especially recently fabulous, compelling, pristine audio of George Quasha reading his Preverbs. Michelle,
it's so great to be here.
It's really good to see you.
Why don't we agree? I haven't seen Michelle in like 10 years, and it's great.
Yeah, I've been teaching a few of your books, Chris, so it's great to have you here at Penn.
Chris, it's really good to see you. I always think of you as a Hudson Valley guy. You're in Connecticut now.
I came down from Newark last night. I was teaching my digital poetry course last
night. At NJIT, where you have been on the faculty forever.
26 years.
26 years.
Well, yeah.
It's good to see you. And thank you, I'm saying for the record, because you've already heard me thank you, and I did it a little in my intro. Thank you for all the years of, you know, sharing with us the amazing recordings that you've done, new and old. Really amazing.
I find Penn Sound to be utterly inspirational, and I don't mind saying that it inspired me to start my own archive, and I hope it eventually leads to other people starting their own micro-archives, their own rogue archives.
Absolutely, rogue archives. If you want to figure out how it is to become a rogue archivist of audio, get in touch with Chris Funkhauser.
No, or Chris Mastaza.
Okay, all the Chrises, and Chris Martin, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, Brooke.
Yes.
So good to see you.
It's so great to see you, Al.
This is good. You light up my life. this is great. You know, this rambling intro that we've done, actually so relevant to Giongiorno. So let me just say, as we move on, that we four have gathered here to talk about a piece created by Giongiorno titled Everyone is a Complete Disappointment. It was included on the album Giongiorno and Ann Waldman, A Culture Selection, culture spelled with a K, released in 1977 from the Giorno Poetry Systems label, an album that included 2 Giorno pieces and 4 Waldman pieces. Among the latter, the Waldman pieces, the famous Fast Speaking Woman, and also White Eyes. Everyone is a Complete Disappointment was recorded on May 1st, 1977 at ZBS Media. It's 26 minutes long, far too long for us to play in its entirety here on Poem Talk. We will post a link to the entire recording to our Poem Talk program notes published in Jacket 2. And here, before we talk about the work, we'll listen to an excerpt of 5 minutes and 10 seconds or so. So here now is the late John Giorno. Everyone is a Complete Disappointment.
You give us 20 minutes, and we'll give you the world. Cause when you're smiling, when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you. When you're laughing, the sun comes shining through. But when you're crying, you bring on the rain. And it's a complete waste.
And it's a complete seeing anyone you ever knew. And it's a complete waste.
Seeing anyone you ever knew. And it's a complete waste. And the way you know. And the way you know you're dead is when you breathe out. You can't breathe in again. You can't breathe in. You can't breathe in again. Deep down, honey. Deep down, honey. In the dark of night. In the dark of night. Deep down, honey. In the dark of night. When I lay my head down to sleep.
When I lay my head down to sleep. When
I
lay my
head down to sleep. I know everything's gonna be all right. 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 I got my baby.
It is impossible for you. It is impossible for you ever to be disappointed. It is impossible for you ever to be disappointed.
Because every moment is a disappointment. Because every moment is a disappointment. Every moment I'm stuck with you. I can't believe how much I don't love you. I can't believe how much I don't love you. I can't seem to shake you off the sled. I can't seem to shake you off the sled. And it's a pleasure to know you really aren't. It's what I dreamed possible.
You're an illusion.
If only I didn't hate you so much. And it's not as though you got anything to lose. I want to dance my life away. Honey from the knife. Lick it, honey from the knife. Like you did to me.
And I still got the hungries. Back on the street.
And love and her is easier than anything I'll ever do again. And you're cruising, and you're cruising, and you're cruising. And your jaws are biting themselves, and your jaws are biting themselves. And there's a nerve inside your cheek. And there's a nerve inside your cheek that's going tick, 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 tick. And you gotta concentrate, you gotta concentrate, you gotta concentrate, because you got a knife in your hand, because you got a knife in your hand, because you got a knife in your hand, and you're gonna stick it in his heart, and you're gonna stick it in his heart. You gotta be relaxed and confident. You just gotta put it there. I don't want to be reborn again.
Strawberry jam. Strawberry jam.
All right, let's go around and say, starting with Michelle, what we heard. What did you hear, like, generally?
An assemblage of either borrowed phrases, reminding me a bit of a kind of truism, a Holzer, a little pornographic like Finley.
Nice. Good start, Brooke.
What I heard is also, I felt like some of the borrowed phrases had, like, there were things happening with the language, like an accent or like somebody's own way of saying it. First, I was like, are they written phrases? But then I started to recognize, like, maybe the speaker in the poem wouldn't speak those words that way or, like, with that kind of accent. So I was interested in that.
In the sound of the voice, you're hearing a persona. That is, it's not the speaker, but it's some performance of someone else.
Yeah.
That's actually a good key. Chris, what'd you hear?
That's interesting because I didn't get that sense at all, except for the very beginning whenever he was doing the radio.
22 minutes. You give us 22 minutes,
right.
We'll give you the world. That's
very,
WINS, I think, in New York, maybe.
It's one of the big, huge AM radio stations, right. Or maybe they're on FM too. So that I recognize. The rest, I'm willing to, you know, I see more or less original. But what I'm hearing, what I've always heard in Giorno from the very first time I ever heard his work, is that how the use of technology really complicates the work and makes it multidimensional. And I'm hearing that throughout this segment. And one of the things I think we'll talk about is that very, you know, dynamic.
Michelle, how do you hear technology? How does one hear technology?
It's really interesting, especially with someone who teaches performance and is a performer and director and someone who does this kind of digital archive work, just sort of thinking about, you know, the voice as technology or technology as a kind of technology. It's challenging for me to read it that way, and I'm excited to sort of collaborate with this group and sort of think about the ways I hear like a sort of chorus or refrain or repeating. My sense is that there's a bit more going on than just that, what I'm hearing.
Can, Brooke, the technology, in a literal way, can we hear the technology? Can one hear technology in a recording?
I mean, I think you do start to, because I don't know how these pieces were made, but when I'm listening for inflection, I feel like, oh, it's the same inflection, but the voice sounds different. So I'm like, is there a voice changer or is this rehearsed or how is this edited? Like, you're aware of all those things. And then there's like two levels of repetition. There's the repetition spoken, but then there's the echo and the relationship between like a repeated phrase and an echoed phrase. And that seems to be like a play with the technology. The technology can do that, but when you repeat the phrase, that is not. It is a technology of repetition, but it's like one person speaking it over and over.
It is one person speaking it over and over. But I think what he's using there is a digital delay, which is a common like effects pedal that guitarists will use and whatnot. It can be used for the voice as well. But we have the situation where in Giorno's work, the way he's composed it, I mean, if we look at the page, and we're not looking at the page, we're listening, but you can see like a
mirror. Let the listeners know that Chris is holding up a score. We'd call it a score, probably,
Part of what we heard, that's right. But he's got two columns. And the thing that Brooke was talking about, yes, there is a repetition in the text, and that's multiplied through his use of the technology. But you can read the columns of this as almost like a poem itself. But the thing that happens with this particular case in this poem, and I don't get this in every single Giorno piece, is that he almost becomes like he's talking to himself, right? And I don't know if you all got that or not, but it's sort of profound that way.
Do you hear that?
I think not necessarily a talking to oneself, but a talking sort of a conversation with oneself, where I sort of thought perhaps. I know about some of his other compositional practices that he would often record before, bring to a gallery space, bring to a performance, and then sort of talk on top of it. And so it's interesting that this is recorded. And obviously, if he had done this performance a number of times, it would be possibly different
Sure.
each time. And so in a way, he is sort of reacting to himself, though he knows what he did. But if you repeat something, it's probably hard to remember all of your different inflections. So I wonder if he's surprised by himself talking to himself. I mean, it's like an endless refusal of answering. It's just repetition.
I hear a certain kind of madness that comes from an inundation. I was a kid who grew up with the same inundation of the radio sounds and the cliches, and a madness that comes from losing oneself and turning into a repeater of bullshit. You know? I don't know. Do you hear? Am I way off?
As soon as you said madness, I actually like got stuck with the word mad because there is a kind of rage. It has, you feel it very like almost. And when you said poem talk earlier, I sort of like misheard it as punk talk, but it does have a kind of punk rage feeling and like a real cacophonous.
Totally.
So I sometimes you like, yeah, I just grabbed that. That mad, like he's mad. And whether it's internalized or he's like processing the world in that way. But
I guess what I'm saying is that if we hear the anger or we sense that the anger at himself or at the world, and then you hear him say, because when you're smiling, the whole world smiles with you. 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 When you're laughing, you're laughing. When you're laughing, the sun, etc. And if you're angry saying that, you become something else. You become a vehicle for anodyne happy talk. And that, to me, is why I use the word madness, because it can drive you a little nuts to find out that you are a repeater.
First thing I do want to say is Giorno was, in his life, maybe the last 50 years of his life, was a hardcore Buddhist. So the first noble truth is all of life is suffering. So, I mean, that, and there's references towards the end of being not wanting to be reborn and what have you. So, and even amidst that, he does find the ecstatic, joyful activities that he talks, that come through so clearly. But back to the dual voices. I mean, that to me is such a profound part of this piece. And when he's saying, you know, the digital delay allows this to happen, and then he's, you know, I'm stuck with you. And then the technology's talking back to him. I'm stuck with you. I can't shake you off the sled, you know. So, yes, it could be the world. It could be the self. But in any case, the technology is enabling this and at the same time is affecting him or something like that.
Mm.
I mean, it's interesting because I was reading a bit, an interview that Giorno did in the Chicago Review in the 80s, where he talked a bit about an attempt, I think, as lots of performers or artists do, to sort of like present one's subjectivity as a performance. And it's interesting that to present this subjectivity, it requires a multiplication of the individual subject. But there is something, I think, in his words, which are, if they might be subjective, but they are rather universal. He talks about after Kathy Acker was at a reading asking her, like, what do you remember, like, from my performance? And, like, what she pulled out, like, meant something to him. Like, that was sort of, like, Kathy Acker's takeaway from, you know, his long refrain. And really interesting to sort of think about subjectivity multiplied in that way when so many poets just focus so much on, like, singularity.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm thinking it back to the technology question, too, and how this is made. When I look at that paper, I'm like, did the performance happen first? And then
exactly.
This is just a record of it. And then also, at first, you know, you think about, it feels edited. But then I'm like, oh, what's the technology at that point? And then you think about pedals or delay pedals, and there's something he's doing, which is listening, right? And that's actually a huge part of it, because when you're working with delay pedals, you're sort of making choices as you're like thinking in both directions. Now it makes me rethink even the beginning of the sound at the beginning.
Sure.
And setting that up and establishing it, and then how long do you sit with something or how much do you adjust it?
I think Giorno is a great monologuist, but what we have here is several voices sort of following from what you just said. So my question is, can it be a monologue if, in fact, a reverberation voice might be affecting the way the voice that's creating the first sound thinks of himself or themselves as a monologuist? It's not really a monologue because there seem to be other voices.
But then it goes back to talking to himself. Like, we're circling back to the idea of talking to himself. So if he's a monologue, like, then he's speaking back. He's hearing himself and speaking back to it and moving on. It's almost like Meisner-esque. Like, you sit with something or you're in something long enough and you hear it and it shifts to something else. Mm. And then I guess my next question is then, what is written down? Is there, like, a series of lines that he knows he's going to use, or is he pulling? Like, where is the material coming from
while
he's performing it?
Well, this is a poem from an anthology. So I had this very same argument with myself. What comes first? How does this develop? Does he write a text and then record it, and then he writes the second part of the text? I mean, it's hard to identify what comes first. In this case,
it's 1977. What literal was he splicing with a razor and tape?
I don't think so. I think he was using a delay in the
and
studio.
And so he was recording the performance without then later editing.
Well, there may have been some sort of editing, especially if he was in a recording studio. But
and this is on tape,
right? It would be on magnetic.
And where is the tape? Any of that?
I'm not sure. I was in touch with the Giorno Foundation fairly recently because I was doing research on the engineer. A woman engineered this record, but they don't know anything about her. I think that she eventually she went into radio. But we'd have to come up with a new word for what he's doing here, like monodialogist.
Something
like that.
Oh, you're responding to my question. I really appreciate that. I really do, because I'm trying to figure out. I think of it as a monologue, but I also think of it as, especially if it's improvised or partly improvised, you were saying, if you have someone producing a follow-up sound, it might affect what you then do as a next original sound.
Well, he's definitely listening to and has tweaked the device and practiced with the device, so he knows what to expect. It's not all some sort of aleatoric thing flying back at him, although I'm sure he would have been very good at that. He's not improvising this. This is something that is coming through. And the thing about this, all this technology and his even use of a digital delay, for me, when I heard, I was like, this guy's a rock star.
Well, also, he memorized all of these things. He wrote somewhere that he could memorize 1,500 lines. That to me is like a machine. That is more than a monologuist. That is
what is it?
Like a computer. I just don't know, especially these kinds of lines, whether he wrote them or not, and they are rather general. Like, how do you remember the order of that? It blew my mind when I read that.
It comes from deep within.
What's the category of performance art here? Who are the relatives? Who are the descendants? Who are the antecedents? I mean, John Cage would do sometimes something a little like this. Laurie Anderson would much later do some stuff.
Didn't
like
Giorno
this.
Sometimes perform at punk venues, like for punk audiences? And that he would say that audience was like ripe and ready for the poetry, the seeking it.
That's true.
I mean, this is kind of your field. How do you feel about how this belongs to your world?
Well, I think all of that stuff, that was such a hot moment in performance and in theater. Like, they were so interconnected, right? Like, visual art, contemporary, like, composition and punk rock or rock and roll and poetry. They were so interconnected. Like, I was just, as I was looking at the lists of the dial-a-poem artists and thinking through just the people he's listed with in the first dial-a-poem, like those, I mean, it's the 70s, so it's a little before all the downtown, like 8BC and Pyramid Club and those, like, events that were happening theatrically in lofts, but all of that comes out of this moment, which is this, like, deep collaboration between theater artists, poets, visual artists, and composers.
Yeah, like I was thinking to answer your second question, someone who worked with tape loops like Charles Amerkanian, he did text and sound work. I mean, Laurie Anderson obviously is a I mean, maybe a acolyte or something of Giorno. I think he would have come first. There are other vocally oriented people who played with the effects.
Yeah, the sort of middle stage of Karen Finley.
But
would
also
be a little like this.
Kurt Schwitters.
And Schwitters is the originator, probably.
Exactly.
Right?
I mean, her sonata has plenty of this kind of stuff. I mean, I hate.
I noticed that Christian Buck was in this in the dial-up home, and I was thinking about Buck's performance of Schwitters that he did at Penn, and they're like they're.
Which is available on Penn Sounds.
Yeah, it was at North.
He memorized her sonata too.
So there is something here that to me. And I was reading it sort of through some of the conceptual writers, which, Chris, your work definitely also figures. But there was a way that this really reminded me of, like, Rob Fitterman and Kenny Goldsmith's work, and it's just, like, insistence on keeping saying something and not waiting for answers.
But he also collaborated with Glenn Branca, yep. Who's, like, that guitarist who would sometimes put like 20 or 100 guitars like all tuned to E and play like three notes, and then it would just be a cacophony of sound, like a wall of sound on like such so very few notes. So I think all of those, like that moment is so profoundly influential to, like, you know, then the Wooster Group or all these other artists and rock stars and composers. But yeah, I don't know.
Let me switch the subject just a little to tone. So the title is Everyone is a Complete Disappointment, which is either hilarious and almost uplifting or, you know, just a bummer. There's some anger. There's some violence here. When he's into when I lay me down to sleep, you have the sense that no one is sleeping. This is not a place. This is not a time or a mode for sleeping. So maybe it's just ironic and clever, or maybe it's a bummer. Maybe it's... Michelle, what's the tone?
Man, I mean,
is everyone a complete disappointment?
I didn't feel bummed. In fact, you know, as I was listening, I wasn't waiting for aleatorics, but I was feeling magic. Like I was feeling magic happening, even though it was recorded.
Incantation?
I don't know. Like there's something. It felt spiritual. Like it felt like it was happening. I guess it's supposed to, right?
Tone.
Okay, this may be too much information, but I was taking a hot bath while I was listening to it, and it was very not hot bath listening. You know, it was not relaxing.
It wasn't like,
I was like,
whoa,
this is like, and I did have this, like, you know, I did walk away from it having some, like, broodiness. Like, I started to kind of carry things in my mind, so I don't know, I didn't. So maybe the tone is a little insistent. The tone to me feels insistent.
But not exactly. We can't really figure out exactly what that insistence is, maybe. I mean, I don't want to. I mean, it's not my mm-hmm. inclination to begin with. But I do. I got really into thinking about the disappointment aspect of it and what he might be driving at. And the best I could come up with is that he was not only talking about the world around him, but also there was some self-reflection. And he was not excluding himself from this. And that would be also be, I think, a kind of a Buddhist thing also. So I think it's funny, too. I mean, there's a little bit of, you know, everybody's going, well, why bother, go kill yourself.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, I mean, I get the sense, like, that he sort of took from the world and, like, made this new world, and, like, that world is a disappointment, and so is the poem world. And, you know, I don't think the poem world should always have to save the world. If the world sucks, it's okay for the poem to suck, too, and be sad. I don't think poems should have to save the world.
I'm going to read you a couple of lines, and your job will be to say what it is, okay? Listen to it at the beginning. It's a complete waste. It's a complete waste of time. Seeing anyone you ever knew. It's a complete waste of time. Seeing anyone you ever knew. It's a complete waste of time. It's a complete waste of time. Seeing anyone you ever knew. What's it? What's a complete waste of time?
Life.
Yeah. Connections life. With other people.
When I hear that, I don't hear it as his opinion, his point of view.
He doesn't exactly mean it. but yeah, he's trying to make a point.
It's somebody's point of view, or it's a point of view, but I think it's actually just unraveling it, not committing to it.
I think it's a point of view that exists in the world, and he possibly chose what to highlight. And as listeners in a 25-minute performance, especially typical poetry audiences, are going to possibly listen for a moment or a bite.
We've identified, you give us 22 minutes, we'll give you the world, as, you know, news radio, AM. Let's identify You Make Me Feel Like Dancing.
Oh, Bee Gees?
Bee Gees, what year?
What, disco, 77?
It's almost contemporary with this piece, which is 77, right? Okay, so who's you in the Bee Gees song, who's you? It would be some love interest.
Beloved.
Who's you here?
Well,
it's not Giorno himself, I suppose.
Well, I was thinking before that, you know, there's the suffering and not wanting, you know, acknowledging this whole, that whole aspect of it. But also he finds joy and ecstasy in the world. Obviously, that's part of it as well. So it doesn't really matter who that is, but there's something out there that makes him feel like dancing, a love interest.
But it's a critique of Bee-Gees-ness.
You think? Because I don't think the Bee Gees
had to feel like dancing is not John Giorno's cup of tea, I think.
Yeah, but dancing might have been. So, I mean,
Bee
Gees don't have the corner of the market on
why
dancing.
Why you gotta hate the Bee Gees? Well, I'm stuck on this idea that even if you're doing this really sophisticated art, or you're thinking about art or language in a new way, that you dislike or disdain popular culture. Because I think you can actually do both things. You can like popular culture and have it kind of pass through you in a way that's interesting and not be like horrified by it or bringing it in to sort of show what's wrong with it.
Mm-hmm.
That it is actually just so present.
Isn't Dial-A-Poem a great expression of the point you just made, which is an effort to use a ubiquitous device to have people get a little poetry in their lives? Is that a fair way of describing Dial-A-Poem as a project?
That was a radical project.
It was radical, except it used cultural ubiquity to get to it.
Technological cultural ubiquity, in fact. I mean, so sure. But I don't think there was... I don't think that Giorno was, he was not interested in conformity. And he was, I don't think he might have been happy to get a big paycheck for something, but to be mainstream, he knew what he was doing was a mainstream. He was a beatnik, bohemian, gay Buddhist, you know, guy who, I mean, he, of course, all poets want to hear or connect with an audience and have people hear what they do.
I totally agree with everything you said, except Dial-A-Poem is an outreach project, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I haven't listened to all of the Dial-A-Poem selections he had, but I read a little bit about the history, and my sense was that he did make some choices that were meant to sort of grind against what everyone might have liked, that there were some Dial-A-Poem things he published that were not traditional poems or poems for kids, and there was some, he liked to be a bit of a provocateur and possibly or an intense provocateur. A lot of the poems were pornographic, which is not when you dial a phone.
You could dial
and hear a pornographic poem. Hear,
okay,
but also Dial-A-Poem, it makes me think of like all the hotlines for queer folks and
completely.
Lesbian folks. Like you have to call these hotlines and then there's someone on the other side who can be like, if you want to go somewhere for bears or if you want to, like, have a quick hookup or if you need a gay plumber to come to your house who's not that kind of a plumber, like a plumber who will fix your plumbing, actual plumbing. this is getting out of control. You won't, like, you know, out you. So I do think that Dial-A-Poem probably has some relation to that, to this whole culture of people that are deeply dependent on access to culture and access to intimacy and their world through the phone.
Brooke, that was amazing.
And the technology was there so that they could do it. I mean, he was hooked on, you know, early on. He capitalized on that. I mean, not monetarily, I don't think, but he certainly was exploiting the ability to do such a thing. And I think that is, It's so amazing how the technology can drive the content. The content can drive the technology. But the processing, whatever he's doing, really connects with the work. And that in this case, I mean, when you hear another piece of Giorno say, I don't want it, I don't need it, I don't want it, someone cheated me out of it, which is one of his famous pieces, like that becomes more of a mantra. Whereas in this piece, I really get the sense that sometimes technology really helps the artist and sometimes it just is there. But in this case, I think it really helps. Mm.
I also wonder about like phone booths as advertising spaces. Like, how do you get information out? Because I know like early Jeff Weiss or, you know, a actor would actually pick up their scripts from a phone booth. They would call Jeff and then Jeff would tell them their role and then their like role would be named in the script in a phone booth. But I think like there are, I don't know that period, like how advertisement or how people learned about things, but dial-a-poem also as like a form that you could just go somewhere. Like, how is it advertised? How do people know how to dial a poem is an interesting question, because I know some downtown shows and downtown events were literally advertised in phone booths. Like, people knew which phone booths that would have the information that they would be interested in.
Hmm. I have a question for Chris, and specifically about his work. But then I would like to have everybody offer final thoughts on this, something that you wanted to say today but haven't had a chance to yet. Chris, in your thinking about pre-1995, you know, sound art and technology and computerish, where does Giorno fit in that prehistory?
Performance poet who used technology, that would be my raw, fresh thought. I don't think of, Giorno was not interested in computers so much at this time. I'm pretty sure he was using analog equipment. We used the phrase digital delay, and there were maybe digital components, but it's not like he had
a
laptop.
It's not actually digital.
It's not a laptop. Mm-hmm. I hope that someone, including maybe even him, sort of cataloged his process. And this is one of the reasons I was trying to get in touch with the foundation about, you know, the engineering of such. I mean, Anne Waldman might know because, she was around. There may be people who worked with him. But I would say, yeah, performance poet.
So I know Anne listens to Poem Talk. So, Anne, we're talking to you. Call us up and dial us and tell us how it all worked. Okay, final thoughts, starting with Michelle. One more thing you wanted to say.
I don't often think about poetry and magic. It's not a research interest of mine, but there's something about this that is just making me think about mass media and magic, and that's my final thought, reminding everyone that there might be magic here.
I love it. Brooke?
I just was surprised, actually, by the technology of it, because I know I'm so interested in that moment in the history of New York and the history of poetry and art, but I actually hadn't heard any poetry like this before from that moment. Like, the way that I had to really think through the editing or how was this done, and I didn't think about the pedals or how that was done, and I think it's really ahead of its time technologically. It took me a while to figure out like how difficult that was to make or how creative to make work that way.
And excellent, which is why I'm just so happy you and I co-curated this episode. We thought about it together, and this is such a great choice. I'm so glad that Giorno is now in the catalog of Poem Talks.
Well, he should be. And this is captivating, that the types of things, that qualities of the work that Brooke was talking about, it was captivating me when I first heard this, maybe I was 20 or so. And it drew me in. But the thing I wanted to say in conclusion, which I didn't bring up earlier, we haven't really talked too much, is there is some narrative to it. I mean, I find that there's a story. He's telling a story about his, whatever it is, views of the world, views of self. It could be all these things. But by the end of the clip we heard, and certainly as it goes on, there's a 25-minute version of this piece, something emerges from that that we could call narrative, I think.
Mm. It's a story being told.
A bit of a story, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And what starts out as maybe being a simple story gets more and more complex as it goes along. And why is that? Well, the world is that way, isn't it? You know. But he was in Giorno. I did happen to cross paths with him a few times, and he couldn't have been more generous and receptive to inquiries and the sort of edginess that comes through. He was, I mean, I'm sure he had his moments, but as a person, he was pretty sensitive and open, and not just like a, you know, angry person. I mean, we all have a lot to be angry about, but he.
His interviews seemed really generous, the ones that I read. He seemed like a really generous interviewer, even when people interviewing him didn't know his expertise.
And also, just thinking about his work, when you look on his website and then you see, like, oh, it's these albums, whether it's the call, whatever, Dial a Poet or Dial a Poem, the way that you see more albums actually on the website for sale or as a record of him than the books themselves, like thinking about that as a legacy, as like the sound is, and the album and the record is more of how he left his legacy than a book that you put in your pocket.
Mm.
There is a collected Giorno, I think. I haven't seen it, but I would like to get a hold of it.
Wait, how is it possible that you haven't seen it if there is such a thing?
This can't be true.
No, what do you mean?
Aren't you a completist?
No, I think I read about it, too, just today when I was reading.
My library is holes.
I read about it. It's put out by Soft Scroll Press. I just read about it.
So there it is. We should have known that. You can't start a Poem Talk conversation and not know where the book. I am
a complete disappointment, actually.
You aren't. You're the best. You're the best. I love
conclusion.
Hanging around with you.
That's how it ends.
I get a final thought, and it's about the word disappointment. I've puzzled over the title of a Wallace Stevens poem, Disillusionment of 10 O'Clock, for years. I never really understood what the list disillusionment means. It doesn't mean that I'm seeing reality straight, you know, I'm disillusioned, I'm down. It means the elimination of illusion, right? I have an illusion, and then disillusionment is the end of the illusion, which means reality, and it also, anyway. Disappointment, I take to be similar. Not to make too big a deal out of the several voices here, or let's just say two, because there's always one echo. That's a kind of appointment. And we think of like a meeting. Appointment is a meeting. An engagement of a self and an alter ego, or a self and an other, an echo that begins to influence the original. And in that sense that I've been talking about on and off here in this conversation. Disappointment is the end, the merging of that doubleness, that appointment, that engagement. It becomes kind of wholer and wholer. I think Michelle's been edging toward this view, you know, so that the split of the self becomes kind of less important, or maybe even merged. You can't even tell which side of the page is the voice, which side of the page is the persona. Well, we like to end Poem Talk with a minute or two.
That's a good point, Al. I just wanted to say.
Thank you. I'm not a complete disappointment.
It goes against the colloquial understanding of what disappointment is, but...
Totally.
But you've really done... I mean, that's a good...
No, totally, right? Disappointment is sad and upset and mad, but disappointment in a neutral sense is the end of that... it's like disillusionment. You know?
Yes. It goes back to almost a Buddhist concept. I mean, I think this is the thing that has to be said about Giorno. He was a Buddhist activist. I mean, he's now the foundation at the bunker, right? He's a big Tibetan Buddhist.
And I guess what I'm saying about disappointment is that it's part of that, what he's trying to convey here in a bit of a pun with the use of this colloquial, everybody's a disappointment. Well, as I said a minute ago, we like to end Poem Talk with a little bit of Gathering Paradise, a chance for several of us, or all of you, if you're quick, to spread wide our narrow hands to gather a little something really good, to hail or commend someone or something going on in the poetry world, the art world, the performance world, the film world, the music-making world. Who's got one?
Well, my first of four engagements here at Kelly Writer's House today.
This is a quadruple day for you.
It was a radio interview with Lainey Brown. And so I think that, you know, her book, the translation of Lily's back into Liszt is
her new
provocative
book.
Read. But on the side, I mean, actually my main reading thing is this book that makes me really unproud to be an American. It's called Poisoner in Chief by Stephen Kinzer. And it's about the MK Ultra experiments that the CIA was doing. And this is I'm wondering how they could have even thought to do these horrific things.
In the whole 180-some episodes, I think this is 185, a poem talk, no one has ever taken Gathering Paradise down to hell like that.
Yeah.
Quite.
Sorry about that, Al.
Gathering hell. No,
disappointing.
That's fine.
It's a little disappointing. It's a little disappointing,
it's
but.
It's complete disappointment.
You can edit that part out.
No,
just
we're
leave
not
it
going
with Lainey.
To. Besides, you came the longest way of all the poem talkers today. So you get a two-part Gathering Paradise. You're fine. Michelle, gather some paradise.
I'd love to gather paradise about a press called Phonograph Editions out of Portland. They just published a book by Hillary Plum called Whole Studies. They also release LPs of poets reading their work, and Peter Gizzi's LP, which you can listen to on Spotify, is truly why I wake up in the morning.
Wow.
And I would stay awake all night listening to it if I could stay awake.
Wow.
Thanks, Phonograph.
Ooh.
Brooke?
Mine is, I also a small press that I can't remember the name of. It's based out of England, and you have to, you subscribe. You're a subscriber, and you just get the books by their authors. But this book came out called After Sappho by Selvi Lynn Schwartz, And it reminds me, in a way, of this conversation because it tracks these lesbian writers and makers back in sort of, all the way through to maybe Gertrude Stein or something, but sort of like how this culture of being a radical and doing things sort of outside of form and structure, and how it's kind of bound into this secret world of transness or sex or lesbian sort of, yeah. Worlds. It's cool. It's based on real authors and writers, but it also is sort of imagining this sort of interior conflict and, it's awesome. After Sappho.
Great recommendation. All right. Karit, we've talked a lot about Chris today, so my Gathering Paradise is about the two of you as Paradiesel. First of all, Brooke O'Hara, I have never had the chance to be inside your classroom, but I have heard about it forever. Starting when you were teaching at Bates College, and my own daughter, Hannah, was your student. And there wasn't a, let's say, folks listening from Bates College, please don't take this the wrong way. Let's just say there wasn't a ton of experimental pedagogy going on up there in that cozy little main spot. But you blew her mind. She couldn't stop talking about how the classroom experience didn't feel like a classroom. Anyway, and now that you're my colleague here, and I constantly hear students come out of your classes and say, oh, my God, this has changed the way I think about everything.
Oh, that's so nice. Well, I love teaching. And I've been teaching more creative writing now that I'm part of creative writing. And I am learning so, as a maker, as a director, I'm always thinking about text and how text comes to life. But working with writers has just changed my enthusiasm.
You do some amazing wild things. And then there's Michelle Taransky. Holy Toledo. Two things to say about you. One is you teach much of the teaching you do is a required course, which is a writing course. It's a much more interesting version of an old composition course. And you teach a lot of this kind of stuff in it, and the students come pouring out of this critical writing seminar ready to become part of the creative writing community, and it's just such a feat of magic.
Thank you for building this house and this place where we can do such amazing things. I think I'm looking at Brooke and Chris, and
huzzah.
I mean, you built this place where we can do the things. Sorry,
the thing that's also important is there is so much buy-in with the students in this
amazing.
Community, and they're so present, and they walk around in their Kelly Writer's House outfits and it,
tote bags and their tote uniforms. Bags. Their tote
outfits.
They're like shirts and their bags. And it is, you do feel as someone here grateful to be part of a community where the students identify with the community. That is not a thing that always happens.
Well, okay, thank you. That's very sweet. This sort of backfired, but I would just want to say something else, a fact about Michelle. We've had, I think I said 185 episodes of Poem Talk, a lot, many years. And there's only been one episode where I was not the host. And it was Michelle Taransky.
Tell them who the guests were, please.
I think it was about Ron Silliman.
I think it was either about Ron or about Bob, and Ron was there or Bob was there.
I think Bob was
there. And Rachel.
And Rachel.
Yeah.
So anyway, I had to go away suddenly, family emergency, and you sat in. And
it's a great experience.
You know, everybody should go back into the catalog.
Please don't.
And look for that. Well, that's all the complete disappointment we have time for on Poem Talk today. Poem Talk at the Writer's House is a collaboration of the Center for Programs in Contemporary Writing and the Kelly Writers House at the University of Pennsylvania and Penn Sound and the Poetry Foundation, poetryfoundation.org. Thanks so, so much to my pals, my friends, my guests, Michelle Taransky, Brooke O'Hara, and Chris Funkhauser. And thank you, Chris, once again for coming all this way to be with us today for a quadruple header, which is, you know, still we have an event left an hour from now, the annual Mind of Winter program. And which is chasing the winter blues away by talking about cold. It's weird. And to Poem Talk's directors and engineers today, Zach Cardner, as always, and also Paul Burke. And to Poem Talk's editor, the same amazing Zach Cardner. Next time on Poem Talk, Amber Rose Johnson, Erica Hunt, and Davy Niddle will join me to talk about two poems by the late and much missed June Jordan. This is Al Filreis. And I hope you join us for that or another episode of Poem Talk.